gravity. That's just the way orbital mechanics works. And so by having a very careful interferometry measurement of the distance between the two, the Ka band frequency, let's assume it's around 24 gigahertz, where the wavelength is like a third of an inch. So each third of an inch is a 360-degree phase shift of the basic carrier frequency being transmitted from one satellite to the other. Let me drop. And if they got the right kind of a deep space, what do they call it now, coherent ranging system like they used on the Apollo mission, the deep space mission, you can get sub-wavelength accuracy. So they can get fractions, very small fractions of an inch of accuracy of the exact distance between the two satellites, even though they're tens of miles apart, maybe even hundreds of miles, but probably tens of miles apart. So therefore, the very gentle dip down that occurs in the orbital altitude and velocity of satellite number one that's going over that mass concentration compared to satellite number two that's behind it, you plot that information and you eventually build up a data set that when you operate on it is a little bit like computer-aided tomography. In the case of computer-aided tomography, you're really taking something that looks like an ordinary black and white X-ray picture of the human being. But if you then rotate the human being 1 degree and take the picture again, and rotate him 1 more degree and take the picture again, and you put all those pictures together just right, you then start building up a three-dimensional picture of what's inside that human being. You find out the density of the objects, the location of the objects, and so on. So computer-aided tomography, that kind of a Fourier transform mathematics is what's being used here. By adjusting the distance between the satellites and the way you take the data, you could say that you're measuring the mass concentrations that are either near the surface, a little bit further down, or all the way down to the core. You'll eventually know. Turns out they've already done that on the Earth. Let me drop. In the case of the Earth, in the case of a nuclear submarine, where the nuclear submarine can do water desalinization, it can take seawater in with the electronics on board, it can turn it into pure water, turn it into oxygen and hydrogen. In other words, a modern-day nuclear submarine, in theory, doesn't have to come up to the surface for a year if it doesn't want to. So if you really want your nuclear submarine to be hidden, you keep it down pretty deep. You don't bother letting it go to the surface. And now the real question is, how do you navigate? Well, the Navy has done a very accurate job of mapping all of the gravity mass concentrations on the Earth. And as such, you move the submarine, you look at the change in gravity of the places you're going through, you recognize the pattern, and say, oh, I know where I am. I'm 45 miles off the eastern tip of Montauk Point, because that's the way the gravity map is falling. So by carefully mapping the gravity of the Earth, you get a very accurate way of locating yourself, even though you don't come up to the surface, you're not using the geo-positioning satellites and so on. So to do that on the moon is now going to tell them, was the moon once molten? Were the great big meteors and comets and whatever that hit, did they make mass concentrations? They're going to try to explain why the near side of the moon has got all of these marias, these molten-looking areas, which are believed to be where volcanoes used to flow out all of their lava in the early days of the moon, whereas the backside of the moon is all pockmarked. And I'm reasonably sure the backside is pockmarked because that's the side that's facing the space continuously, because the moon is in a locked synchronous orbit. Its rotation and its revolution are one and the same. You know, it rotates once on its axis once every 28 days and goes around the Earth once every 28 days. I'm rounding off the numbers, but you know what I mean. So one side of the moon is always facing towards outer space. Therefore, most of the meteors that come into the Earth-Moon binary system are more likely to hit the back side of the moon. To curve all the way around and hit the front side means you have to either go whizzing by the Earth and just barely miss it, or you've got to somehow do a very fancy circular orbit and then impact the moon. So hitting the Earth side of the moon is very difficult. That's part of the reason why the Earth side is so much smoother than the back side. But still, where are the more mass concentrations, and are those mass concentrations part of the explanation for how the moon so easily ended up into a lockstep rotation and revolution? Man type stuff. Do we really need to know that? You're always going to get somebody asking that question. It's just another one of these areas of science where you don't know how you're going to use the data, but once you've got it, somebody will eventually find some very good way of using it.
You have need of a landing deck.
Yeah. Landing information, well, you didn't have that information, and yet Apollo 11, 12, 14, 15, 16, and 17 landed very well.
Accurate landing.
Okay. But I have reason to believe that mankind is probably not going to go back to the moon for an awful long period of time. Like, if we go there in 15 years, I'll be amazed. What do you think, Paul?
I'm counting on it. Hopefully they'll reinstate the Constellation program, but I think I got high hopes for that. Well, at least they kept the Orion part of it. And, oh, by the way, the size of these things, a lot of people want to know the size. It's roughly about 4 foot by 4 foot, a little bit less than that. They're not big spacecraft. They do have solar panels sticking out from them. In fact, the solar panels aren't on motors. They're kind of like permanently attached to the spacecraft. They don't want to move the spacecraft. You know, if you start moving the solar panels, that might affect the measurements that they're getting. You know, would be very minute, but they don't want any kind of a change. They do have these. It's not all that heavy, about 400 pounds. They write it up as, I think, 200 kilograms, but bigger than 400-pound area each. Back to you.
Question, Dick?
Go ahead, John.
Paul, Happy New Year to you, too. Got a question. Maybe you or Paul would know. The distance from the Earth to the point at where the gravitational pull between the Earth and the Moon is zero. Do you know what that's called, and about how far out is it? Back to you, Dick.
That would be called Lagrange point number one of the Earth-Moon binary system. There's also a similar Lagrange point a certain distance, roughly 1 million miles from the Earth toward the Sun. That's the Sun-Earth Lagrange point. So this guy Lagrange, way back in 1800 roughly, figured out all the places where there is a stable position. So there's a point, let me pick a number, roughly 10% of the distance between the Earth and between the Moon and the Earth. Let me think now. 240,000 miles, so roughly 24,000 miles away from the mass center of the Moon toward the Earth is Lagrange point number one. On the backside of the Earth from the Moon is Lagrange point number two. On the backside of the Moon, away from the Earth, is Lagrange point number three. Now you make a triangle between Earth, Moon, an equilateral triangle between Earth, Moon, and a point ahead of the orbit. That's Lagrange point number four, and another triangle, equilateral triangle, behind the Moon's orbit, and that's Lagrange point number five. So there are five recognized quasi-stable points, and we've already put satellites. In the case of the SOHO satellite, that one is located between the Earth-Sun system, and so that's roughly 1 million miles away from the Earth toward the Sun. That's a reasonably stable location. SOHO sits there and makes continuous solar measurements for us. The James Webb Space Telescope is going to be on the Lagrange point number, let's see now, 1, 2, 3. Lagrange point number three of the Earth solar system. It's going to be roughly 1 million miles away from the Earth, where the Earth is almost a shield between the Sun and
repeater, timeout, repeater, timeout, cancel.
And James Webb. So James Webb, an infrared telescope, really doesn't want that high temperature solar energy hitting it. So they got a very fancy shield system, and it's also going to be using quite a bit of the shielding characteristics of the Earth.
That's L2, Dick.
Oh, wait, no. L1 is midway between Earth and Moon, or Earth and Sun. I think you're saying the one on the back side is 2, and the one on the far side of the Earth, or the far side of the Sun, is that 3? Do I have them in the wrong order, Paul, go ahead.
Yeah, now you have it right. One is between the Sun and Earth. Two is a million miles out from the Earth. And then three would be the opposite side. That's where planet Vulcan is, you know. The planet that everybody thought might be out there that you can't see because it's on the other side of the Sun. As far as the L5 for the Earth-Moon system, there's a group of space enthusiasts. They call it the L5 colony. You know, they want to set up a gigantic, you know, we could have thousands of people live colony at the L5 because, you know, you really won't need much fuel to keep it there for that group. But there is a group that recognizes that as a possible location for a permanent city in space.
Now, this guy Lagrange, a real good mathematician, around 1800 worked out the details of the so-called stable points. The Lagrange point number one is the only one that doesn't require rotation. In other words, if Earth and Moon were by some magic sitting absolutely steady and not rotating around each other, then Lagrange point number one would still be stable. All the other Lagrange points are only stable if and only if there is rotation going on between those major and minor bodies. On top of that, in order to be stable, the two bodies have to have a mass ratio of greater than 24 than 1. I think it's almost 25 to 1. In other words, the Moon must be 25 times lighter than the Earth in order for the other Lagrange points to be reasonably stable. There's a whole bunch of complicated mathematics as to why that happens. Now, these Lagrange points, you've got them between Earth and Sun, you've got them between Earth and Moon, you've got them between Jupiter and Sun, Saturn and Sun. The Jupiter to Sun Lagrange point number 4 and 5 are where the so-called Trojan satellites or Trojan asteroids are located. There's a whole bunch of asteroids that sit in that little chunk of sky, an equilateral triangle between Jupiter, Sun, and these objects ahead of orbit or behind orbit. So there's objects out there in space between Jupiter and Sun, I think between Saturn and Sun, and I think they've even found one with some of the other planets. So there are a number of crazy stable points in orbit, and the right ratios exist because the Sun is so massive. You hit this 25 to 1 ratio where you end up with these stable orbits of motion. Also, when it comes to Kepler, I think we're going to be hearing more and more about Kepler. Kepler is that spacecraft put up about 2 years ago, and it's staring continuously at a point in space where it's looking at more than 120,000 stars simultaneously in one little chunk of space. And it's waiting for any one of those planets to cross in front of that star, give them a little bit of a blink, and it makes some very precise measurements of the amount of blink, the duration of the blink, and so on. And after you get two or three of those orbits, and they really confirm it, that it's not just a sunspot that flared up or whatever, it really is a satellite body around that particular star, they're now finding more and more of these things. They're finding I'll bet you at least 10%, if not more, of all the stars out there have got a significant number of planets. Is that approximately what you're hearing also, Paul? WS2N, K2LIW?
Yes, I hear the same thing. We're loaded with planets. They thought it was rare, now it's common. So they don't know what to do with them all. Confirmation of a lot of the planets by Kepler are being done on by ground-based telescopes. For instance, the last one that I had mentioned earlier, third-sized one, they use the Keck Observatory in Hawaii to verify that. So, you know, some of the other ones too around the globe. Two other comments I wanted to make about the Grail before I got away from that was, yes, you mentioned the Deep Space Network. They are involved with the Grail project, so you always have somebody right now looking at the two spacecraft, either California or the Madrid or Canberra in Australia. The Deep Space Network is definitely involved. And also, the actual scientific work will be started around March, because that's how long it's going to take the spacecraft to get into a proper 30-mile or 38-mile high orbit there. Polar orbit. Back to you.
Yeah, these are fun projects. There was a significant period of time in which everyone believed that planets going around a star, like our particular 8 or 9 planets, depending on how you want to add them up, was a rare condition. They used to think that was 1 in a million. We now realize that it's extremely typical to have planets around a star. Now, the particular arrangement of planets, where the rocky, heavy planets are in close, the gaseous planets are out far, and some of the gaseous planets are very large and act like protectors. Jupiter and Saturn, two very massive objects, give us a lot of protection, an awful lot of the comets, asteroids, and everything else that would be impacting the Earth really hit Jupiter and Saturn first, the great big targets out there. And so they're giving us a lot of protection, and now we've got a rather stable system of planets that are not slowly migrating out, migrating in, shifting positions or whatever. There's a lot of interaction going on. One of the explanations for those Lagrange points, I mean, why in the world is there a Lagrange point number 4 and number 5, a triangular-shaped object, equilateral triangle between, in the case of the Lagrange point for the Moon-Earth system, at the equilateral triangle of roughly 240,000 miles on the side, and you draw that triangle with one of them ahead in orbit, that's Lagrange point number 4, and one behind in orbit, that's Lagrange point number 5. Why in the world is that a stable point? And the answer is, you think the Moon is going around the Earth. That's too simplistic. The Earth and the Moon are both going around a barycenter, as it's called. In other words, if you put the Earth and the Moon on opposite ends of a great big yardstick, so to speak, and now you hold your finger in the right place so that the...
Repeater, time out, cancel.
You hold your finger in the right place so that the yardstick is now balanced. That's the barycenter. That's the mass center of the Earth-Moon system. That mass center of Earth-Moon system is roughly 1,000 miles below the curvature of the Earth at around the equator. Below the equator of the Earth, 1,000 miles in, is the mass center of the Earth-Moon system. The Moon is going around that mass center. The Earth is going around that mass center. If you carefully plotted what the Earth does in its 365-day orbit around the Sun, you think it's a nice, smooth, elliptical orbit. It's not. It's a scalloped orbit with 12 scallops, because the Earth is wobbling, caused by the Moon, and it makes 12 wobbles per year, because the Earth is literally going around that barycenter, that mass concentration center of the Earth-Moon system. That explains why the tide is 2 tides per day and not 1 tide per day. The 1 tide, the water is being attracted toward the Moon on the near side. But because the Earth is wobbling, the water is being pushed outward on the far side. And that makes the 2nd tide per day. So every one of these systems, the Earth-Moon system is creating a wobble of the Earth. The Jupiter-Sun system is creating a wobble of the Sun. And so as far as that Lagrange point number 4 object is concerned, you think it's looking at the gravity of the Moon and of the Earth in our particular case. It's not. It's looking at the mass concentration of the two, and it's going around that point. And so when it's in just the right place, moving at just the right velocity, it's a stable orbit. So there's a whole lot of these crazy orbits that are stable. Some of them are not at all good common sense. Over to you.
Repeater, time out, cancel.
Over to you for any further comments on this, Paul. WS2N? K2RIW. Oh, by the way, well, when I pass it back to you, Orion, I have the impression Orion is a NASA-funded project. I thought we were going over to commercial launching for space station and for future manned missions. I thought that was going to be commercially funded, but that's beginning to sound like a NASA project, so I'm a little bit confused by this. Over to you, Paul, KTLIW.
Okay, as far as the Orion spacecraft goes, that's being set up for deep space missions. And without any, you know, an external habitat attached to the Orion, the Orion itself would be able to, you could survive on board that thing for 21 days, no problem. Which means it could, you know, they could do long-term flights with this thing. You wouldn't be able to do that with the old Apollo spacecraft. It's going to be bigger, not much bigger, but bigger. And eventually, when you have a habitat attached to it, you'll be able to go off to Mars and go to different asteroids. I mean, this is the planning that NASA has for Orion and probably eventually moon flight. Will it be able to go to the International Space Station? Oh, yes, it will, but, you know, that's not the main objective. They won't need the SLS, this gigantic launch system that they're building, to do that. They plan on eventually heading out to the moon, Mars. These things will eventually come to pass. You're right, the private company, SpaceX in particular, is really involved with sending product back to the space station when we drop it. And a couple of years after that, you know, is underway, they're going to take that same spacecraft. It's called the Dragon spacecraft. And they're going to modify that and eventually take astronauts to and from the International Space Station. And that will be their job. The Dragon won't be able to do anything else. It won't be able to go to the moon. Orion will. Orion will be able to actually go to Mars. One of the plans is to actually go to the moon. They want to land on Phobos or Deimos and bring back stuff, you know. This is what the NASA is thinking about, Dick. One other thing about the tides, before I leave the tides, I had one question about that in the drop. Talking about the shifting of the Earth as part of the reason you have the two tides. I've heard that, but I've also heard there's another reason that adds to that. You know, that alone wouldn't account for the pretty high tide that you do have on the opposite side of the Earth. The other reason for it is, you know, the moon has its gravity and it's pulling the water from the surface of the Earth, pulling it out into space toward the moon. The gravity is stronger looking at the face of the Earth, you know, from the moon's point of view. But because the Earth is 8,000 miles in diameter, that means the opposite side of the Earth is a lot further away than the closest part of the Earth to the moon. And therefore, there's less pull of the moon's gravity on that water on the backside of that moon, backside of the Earth. So it's not pulling that water that much. And that's part of the reason that you now have this. If you look at the diagram, you have a circle for the Earth. You've got the tides being pulled toward the moon and then also away from the moon on the opposite side of the Earth. What do you think of that, Dick? Back to you.
Believe it or not, Paul, both explanations are really almost the same. You could say that the Earth is wobbling around that mass concentration point, the Barycenter, center, because of what the moon's gravity is doing. Most people think the moon goes around the Earth. In reality, Earth and moon are a binary system. They're going around each other, so to speak. They're going around the mass center. The extra 8,000 miles to the backside of the Earth, giving you less lunar gravity. That's true. However, the water on that side with the less lunar gravity would be sitting at normal altitude, not greater altitude. If I go on the backside of the Earth where the high tide exists, and then I rotate around the Earth one quarter of the turn toward the near side, there the water is at normal altitude, but there's a bulge on the real backside of the Earth. So the lower gravity wouldn't make the water bulge up higher than normal altitude. I think the wobble is the real dominant factor. Both exist, without a doubt, but I think the wobble is the main thing, because it really is a binary system. Now, so Orion is going to be used for lunar missions and maybe Mars missions, and you know I'm a little skeptical on the Mars missions, but it's a good thing from the plan, because maybe somebody's going to find a way, and a variation of Orion is going to become Dragon and used for going to the International Space Station. And I think you're saying the next test flight, I believe you said, is going to be in 1914. Is that true, Paul? Go ahead.
Yeah, that would be the first unmanned actual test flight of the Orion spacecraft. And then figure maybe another year, by that time, another year later, they should have it set up for manned flight. Up to 6 or 7 astronauts on board if they want. The Dragon, it's a different design from Orion, and completely independent of NASA. It's, you know, government funded, but being developed by SpaceX, private corporation, and that has already flown. That's the one that's flown. They're really involved. They built their own Falcon 9 rocket. They've launched it from Cape Kennedy. I have that on tape. And put that into orbit. I mean, it is the spacecraft and rocket being developed by a private company. That's pretty amazing. Being launched from Cape Kennedy, not some private company. You know, they have all this company that's building a launch facility in New Mexico somewhere. But, you know, I mean, these people are on the way. They really got their act together from what I see. Back to you.
Good stuff. Right now, the funding for NASA, has it plateaued? I think we've come down quite a bit from previous years. Has it plateaued, and is anybody planning for it to go back up? Or is it going to stay steady at what it is right now, if you happen to know, Paul? Go ahead.
I think it's pretty close to the same, probably a little less. Like years ago, it used to be 3% of the of what the defense budget was, something like that. Now it's less than that. So you can imagine what goes into the defense. They spend. So, on the scheme of things, the NASA budget is really, you know, peanuts compared to the defense and what we spend on all these other funds. God knows what else. With this money, you've got to support the International Space Station. You've got to support all these different missions, Juno to Jupiter. You get the Cassini mission that's still being funded. You've got the two Mars missions still riding around on Mars. Another one going up there, Curiosity, in August. You still got the Messenger around, flying around Mercury. These are ongoing missions. The Hubble, that's still going. I mean, these things are all being funded out of the same NASA budget.
I had one more question, but I forgot it. Anyone else have any other questions before we end the NASA section? Give me your call letters right now, K2RIW. a question, but it's not related to what you're talking about. Okay, go ahead with your question. It sounds like, my goodness, why can't I think of your caller this? Joe, W-H-O-L-Y-Y. Go ahead, Joe.
It's funny, if you remember my brother's call last for 25 years, even though I haven't talked to him for that long, but he can't remember mine. That's okay. My question was, what's this new thing on what's called hydrogen cells? I guess it's something that's now it's newer than lithium-ion type of batteries. Any news on the things? Any information on these things, how they work? How much better they're supposed to be?
I'm not positive, but I'm going to make some guesses on this one, Joe. And by the way, your audio is quite low. You might want to boost it up a healthy 8 dB, if you know what I mean. In Reykjavik, Iceland, I think they're using hydrogen-powered vehicles. It's a very handy fuel. It's for people who've got a lot of geothermal energy, getting hydrogen is relatively easy for them. For us, you and I would be burning hydrocarbon fuel, oil, and coal, in order to do the separation of the hydrogen from water or the atmosphere. But hydrogen as a fuel is a very nice, clean burning material. You take the oxygen out of the air, the hydrogen of your fuel, you burn the two, you get power out of your engine, and the exhaust is water vapor. And that's kind of handy. So I think there have been a number of projects where they've talked about building a very small version of a kind of a fuel cell that you put into a calculator or a laptop computer, which uses hydrogen as fuel and gives you the electrical power output. There's got to be a couple of people on frequency that have got a lot more smarts on it than I do. Anybody who knows about these hydrogen cells that are being proposed, possibly for portable electronic products or vehicles, give us some words. Give us your call letters right now. KTRIW on the TechNet. Looks like it's just you and me, Joe. And tell me what you know so far, because I've told you about as much as I know. Hydrogen all by itself, whether it be compressed or liquid or whatever, is a very nice fuel, and it burns very cleanly using the atmosphere. And I think there are ways you can build a catalytic converter out of it, a kind of a fuel cell. Normally the fuel cell operates on the ones in space operate on hydrogen and oxygen. Well, here on Earth, the oxygen is already there in the air. You just have to supply the hydrogen. So I think it's a kind of a hydrogen fuel cell that a miniaturized version is being developed, I'd like to believe. And would you get more watt hours or joules per dollar or per pound by way of hydrogen as opposed to lithium-ion rechargeable batteries? I think the answer could eventually be yes. To the HURYY, KTRIW on the TechNet.
Sort of answer the question. I don't really have the answer to it. One thing I did notice about lithium cells, well, I'll give an example, which is something I just recently checked, and I never thought I'd check this before, is right, these batteries you can buy in any place to sell batteries, that say lithium, I guess, I don't have one in front of me right now, actually, just to show you what the name is. But the ones that they're Eveready makes or whatever, they're typically like a silver type of package with blue lighting on the thing. And I'll say lithium on the battery. The terminal voltage on these batteries is 1.8 volts, where typically out of a brand new, like a Duracell, you might get 1.6, 1.62 volts out of a brand new cell. And is that where they're apparently getting the statement last longer in other devices because it's got a higher terminal voltage in them? That was just as far as lithium batteries. But I don't know anything about these new hydrogen batteries, these hydrogen cells, and they apparently said these are going to be used in different devices, probably like these iPads or these tablets. They're going to probably start trying to integrate these things into these type of devices, but apparently they have much, much longer usage at them for the same physical size of the battery. Back to you.
Yeah, one of the things that I've noticed that struck me strange is that I've been collecting batteries for a long time and disposing of them as a toxic waste. And according to the recent calendar I got from Huntington Town, tells me that the rechargeable batteries, whether they be lithium or nickel cadmium or nickel metal hydride, those must be disposed of as toxic waste and brought to a recycling center. But regular non-rechargeable batteries, be they lithium or any other kind, apparently we're allowed to throw them straight into the garbage. That amazed me. Only the rechargeables do you have to not to, throw them into the garbage. And I thought there's some pretty exotic chemistry in even the non-rechargeable ones. Particularly in the old days, I guess they contained mercury. I guess there's none on the market anymore that contain mercury. So maybe that's part of why they can make those comments. The 1.8 volts is a brand new one on me. I know that a pure lithium coin cell, I think, puts out something in the vicinity of 3 volts. The rechargeable lithium ions, lithium polymer, the ones that are used for model airplane control, I don't think they're 1.8. I thought they were closer to 2.0, but maybe I'm confusing those with lead-acid batteries. I'm a bit confused. I wonder if you happen to know. By the way, your audio is still quite low, Joe. Your audio is a good 8 dB weaker than mine. So, and I think you're coming through the... I'm not quite sure how you come into the machine. That's my next question. How are you communicating with us tonight? Is it by Echolink or IRLP? Because I think I'm not hearing you on the input. And I should ordinarily, if that's the way you were doing it. But the voltage that's coming out of the rechargeable batteries that are used on electrically powered radio-controlled model airplane...
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout. Cancel.
Those radio-controlled model airplanes, if you happen to know that voltage, I should. I mean, after visiting those guys all these times, you'd think I'd know the voltage out of their batteries, because I'm not one of those flyers yet. That's one of the reasons I don't know, and it's one of the questions I've never asked these people. I ask them all kinds of questions about how the motor controller works, and boy, that's an exotic piece of electronics. And the motor itself, the brushless DC motor, that's a beautiful design. But I don't know what voltage they put out. So you got me very curious, Joe. W2RYY, T2RYW in the TechNet.
I'm coming in through IRLP. I just went onto my house radio, but it's like off through my repeater. So I think just change channels here. Same way. I now transmit with my house radio directly to my node downstairs, so it's not going through the repeater right now. Is the audio any better?
A tiny bit louder, but still low, Joe. Go ahead.
Okay. Then I think you have a problem with your IRLP connection. Your audio is not adjusted properly, because I'm noticing I'm getting forward audio out to me. It's excessively loud going out on the internet, so I think it's got an imbalance going on. Nothing I can do about it. Let me pick up the other mic. Let's see.
Okay, here's the other mic. Now coming directly on 2 meters.
That was full volume. Beautiful. So the IRLP, a whole lot of resetting of the machine was required tonight. On January 1st, for whatever reason, the machine went into some kind of a hiccup mode, and we had a fair amount of trouble during the first 10 minutes or so of the repeater, of the net tonight. So a massive reset was required. Ordinarily, this TechNet is run in such a way that no PL tone is required, and tonight, PL tone is just definitely required. The very last audio you gave us was full volume. So do you happen to know what voltage is used on radio control model aircraft, rechargeable lithium batteries? Over to you, Joe.
No, I don't know anything about the batteries that go inside lithium, in the radar control planes. I know nothing about those whatsoever, what kind of voltage those packs use. I just happened to ask about hydrogen cells, because I just sort of, I guess, they're not becoming commercial on some devices, so they're going to be starting to use these on newer computers and things like that. And I happened to mention about the lithium battery, because I happened to be checking batteries the other day. They bought a brand new pack of lithium batteries. And I tried those in my LED flashlight. And it actually does seem to give a little brighter light out of the flashlight, being that all three cells in the battery 1.8 instead of like 1.6. So it does seem to make a difference. I'm not sure why they have a slightly high terminal voltage, but I didn't know anything about these hydrogen, with these batteries that call hydrogen cells. I don't know anything about the chemical makeup inside, how they produce the electricity, how good they are, how bad they are, what the pluses and minuses are. That's why I brought it up as a question.
I do remember seeing a cartoon in one of the magazines, like Electronic Design News or Microwave Journal, I'm not sure which one it was, where these new lithium, let me call them lithium fuel cells, that are going to be used in portable equipment like laptops, because they will be using as the raw fuel hydrogen and oxygen from the air, and the effluent coming out of them will be water vapor, that the cartoon literally had water dripping out of your laptop. And there's all kinds of jokes you can make out of that as to wetting the part of your body where the laptop is sitting. So, and is there going to be a fan inside that somehow boils off the water into a vapor form and puts out high humidity into the air? You got to get rid of the water somewhere. Maybe there's going to be a little cup on the side where you dump the water out periodically. So, but still, I think the energy density of a hydrogen-powered piece of electronics, just like a hydrogen-powered vehicle, has certain advantages, and it's certainly going to be one of the kinds of technology that's going to be researched in the future. So it looks like we all got to look into this a little bit more, Joe. Looks like nobody on Frequency has any smarts on this one that has signed in so far tonight. And if somebody does know something, please chime in, because we're winging it on this one. One last call. Have we answered all the questions of people who signed in who had a, let's say, a purely ham radio question? And let's consider even the hydrogen cells as purely ham radio. Give me a call, letters, and name right now if you've got another question. If not, we're going to go over to the more serious stuff. K2RIW in the TechNet.
I actually had something else I was thinking I was to ask you the question, but I wasn't sure if it was really within the topic or scope of this type of net. And that was of that device you had talked about 2 weeks ago that's capable of listening to ultrasonic and bringing it down to human hearing range. That's an interesting thing to talk about, because that almost makes you wonder how that in itself works properly, or how in general how it works. Do you know anything about that mechanism within itself, how it functions?
I sure do, Joe. And as soon as I get out from under my my current obligations, I'm going to visit you. I'm going to hand you all those raw parts, and I could eventually, you could start looking at it right now, because it was a QST magazine article a few years ago. It was on the subject of electromagnetic interference searching, this QST article. In fact, I probably got your email address, therefore I can send it to you tonight as soon as we finish with the net. You can download that article, assuming that you're an ARRL member, and you can start looking at it even before I bring it to you. The method by which it works, let me drop, is it really is a kind of a super heterodyne receiver. If you want to listen to the bat chirping that happens at 40 kilohertz, and if you mix that with a steady state oscillator that's on board running at, let me pick a number, 36 kilohertz, then the 40 kilohertz coming out of the bat, picked up by the microphone and amplified, goes into a mixer stage with the 36 kilohertz oscillator that you got in your unit. You mix the two together, and one of the products is 4 kilohertz. The 4 kilohertz goes into another audio amplifier and comes out of the loudspeaker or the earphones. So, and the oscillator that's on board really is a beat frequency oscillator. It's got a knob on it. You can tune that knob, and therefore you can make the chirping out of the bat come out as a high pitch audio or a low pitch audio in the acoustic range of a human being. So it is a pure superheterodyne mixing action. And you could set the oscillator on the high side or the low side, and you could listen to the chirping out of the bat either right side up or upside down, if you know what I mean. I mean, some bats, during the time they do their chirping, they sweep upward or sweep downward in frequency. That's part of how they do their Doppler ranging and everything else. When the bat finishes doing all of his chirping at a low, medium, and high pulse recurrent frequency, he gets a beautiful three-dimensional picture of that insect that's in front of him, whether or not it's his favorite one that he likes to eat or the one that he's going to reject. It's amazing. You'd be amazed how much of the early radar research done by the Raytheon company was really done by studying the way bats do their thing. And I can remember some of the early brochures. Let me drop. Some of the early brochures from the Raytheon company discussing their airborne radar designs. This was in the mid-60s. The main brochure, which was like a six-page color, 8.5 by 11 document, telling you all the great characteristics of their airborne radar system that they were manufacturing at that time. On the front cover was a full-size picture of a flying bat. and they led you to believe that some of the methods of operation were copied from what Mother Nature was doing. Now, the majority of these frequency translating systems that are being sold as kits or in completely operating form in the United Kingdom, because they got, let me pick a number, 10 different species of bats, and there were various societies in the United Kingdom that just love these bats like crazy, and therefore each one of these hobby groups has their favorite bats. They know what caves they go to. They go there with their listening devices, and at dusk they listen to the bats coming out of the cave, and they follow them with these acoustic devices. So the majority of them are a super heterodyne beat frequency oscillator translator. A small percentage of them do it by frequency dividing. In the case of a bat that maybe, I think there was a bat that goes up to 90 kilohertz, and he sweeps by 15 kilohertz. So no matter how you set the beat frequency oscillator on him, some of his beat down frequency is going to be outside of your acoustic range. You're not going to hear him completely. On that particular animal, they use a frequency divider. Well, the disadvantage of a frequency divider is that it's got a nasty threshold characteristic. In the case of the beat frequency oscillator translator, as the signal gets weaker and weaker, you just hear weaker and weaker acoustic audio coming out of the loudspeaker or the earphones. In the case of a frequency divider, as the bat signal gets weaker and weaker, pretty soon your divider doesn't divide the frequency anymore and you get a sudden stop, very similar to what happens with your and my digital over-the-air television. Beyond a certain signal strength or bit error rate, all of a sudden the picture freezes and the audio disappears. W2RY,
repeater, timeout, repeater, timeout, cancel.
W2RYY, K2RYW, go ahead, Joe.
Okay, so with this device you're talking about, what this basically is doing is a heterodyne type of process, something like recovering SSB signals. So something's far removed from the oscillator, i.e., you're putting out a 36 kilohertz signal from your oscillator. Yes, you could hear a 40 kilohertz signal from the bat. It comes out as a 4 kilohertz pitch. If something also come in at, say, 26 kilohertz, well, that would be a 10 kc difference. You really probably couldn't hear that with the way our hearing works currently. So you sort of have to sweep this thing across a range of the oscillator and have it beat against something to actually have detectable type of audio. I thought the same thing would actually bring, actually make an entire band of audio and make it, you know, I guess, for better lack of a word, put it to the IF range, hearing range of that a person could hear. I thought that's how these things sort of worked. So you, what describing works a little different than I thought these things actually work.
The reason this thing has a beat frequency oscillator is two reasons. Number one, you might want to literally listen to a bat. And your particular favorite bat, you go to the right books, you'll find out that a bat species so-and-so puts out 36 kilohertz and it sweeps to 39.5 during each one of his chirps when he's in the high pulse recurrent frequency mode when he's getting close to the insect, for instance. You can do research and find out where you want to tune it. Second of all, another reason why you want to tune it is a particular microphone that they recommend you buy. You can buy one from the B&K company. You can buy a microphone, and I've seen one of these things that goes from 1 kilohertz to 100 kilohertz, and it's flat. That's the good news. The bad news is that particular microphone is $5,000. You and I are not likely to buy that one, and it's a large object. The tiny little piezoelectric microphone that's inside of that's the recommended thing to put at the focal point of this 2-foot dish, parabolic dish, is the parabolic reflector. It has a particular frequency range that it's tuned to, which I think was something like 22 kilohertz. So when you tune the beat frequency oscillator favoring 22 kilohertz, you get the maximum sensitivity of that particular microphone. You don't have to use that exact frequency, but you get maximum sensitivity. The ultrasonic noise that comes out of a arcing high-voltage insulator on the LIPA power line of the LIPA power line out in front of your house, it's putting out a whole band of frequencies. The only reason you chose ultrasonics is that the signal-to-noise ratio at ultrasonics is considerably higher than at the audio frequencies. Number one is an advantage. Number two, the ultrasonic frequency has a much shorter wavelength because sound travels through air at roughly 1 foot per millisecond. So a 40 kilohertz signal...
Repeater, timeout, cancel.
A 40 kilohertz signal is 1/40th of a foot. So what is that? A quarter of an inch or something like that. So the wavelength in air of a 40 kilohertz signal would be a quarter of an inch. 20 kilohertz signal would be a half an inch. And so out of a 3-foot dish, you end up with something like a 3-degree beam width. So therefore you get a very sharp antenna pattern, acoustic antenna pattern. And by aiming this thing with maybe gun sight you put on it, you can actually figure out exactly which insulator or which portion of the insulator is doing the arcing. So those are some of the advantages and some of the reasons why I think they're going to be frequency oscillator. Now, while you're on the subject, and you picked up a beauty, let me drop. When you're doing a beat frequency oscillator mixing to translate it down, there's nothing stopping you from using something called an image phasing mixer. I'm not sure if a product detector does that, but there's a way of using two mixers in quadrature, two separate doubly balanced mixers. With the right kind of a circuit, you can make an image phasing mixer. What does an image phasing mixer do? You can set it up so that it either favors the high side or the low side. If your local oscillator was on 40 kilohertz and your audio output channel happened to be favoring 4 kilohertz, you can set up the image phasing mixer so that you listen to 44 kilohertz, 40 plus 4, or 36 kilohertz, 40 minus 4. And depending on how you set up the image phasing mixer, you're listening to the high side or the low side only, and the other one is rejected by 20, 30, 40 dB, depending on how well you do a balancing job. So there's a whole fancy circuit called image phasing mixer that when you do mixing, only one side comes through per se. And so in the case of a well-designed receiver, you eliminate the image channel by having a good RF filter in front, not allowing that signal to come through. But you could have a broadband front end with an image phasing mixer. Radio astronomers and other people have used that, and it works very well. I wonder if you ever heard of that one, Joe. W-H-U-R-Y-Y, K-Q-R-I-W.
No, I have not heard of that. And of course, coming from you, I'm not surprised, because you can always throw stuff at me that I've never heard of. But it sounds like a very interesting project. But what this device that you have, or the parts of this device you have, this does not employ something like this, does it?
It doesn't need it, Joe, because in the case of you and I listening to the sizzling sound coming out of an arcing insulator out in front of your house, if I set it up for a local oscillator of 40 kilohertz, and therefore I'm listening with, if I happen to be favoring 3 kilohertz of audio, and therefore I'm listening to either 43 or 37 kilohertz, it doesn't matter. In either case, the arcing insulator is making both of those noises, so there's no real ambiguity factor here. In the case of the bats, if there was one species of bat running at 33 kilohertz and the other species of bat running at 27 kilohertz, and I want to differentiate one from the other, either I'm going to set it on the high side or the low side or one or the other to eliminate the other one, put it out of range, or I'm going to add a little bit more circuitry in there to make an image phasing mixer. At frequencies like 40 kilohertz, you and I can buy for a dollar at a time the highest performance in the world of an operational amplifier. You put together operational amplifiers just right, guarantee you can make the highest performance image phasing mixer that is way beyond what any of the RF guys can normally do. Normally the RF guys are building an image phasing mixer at, say, for instance, 10 gigahertz because they got a 144 meg IF, and they want to make sure they're listening to the right real signal and not listening to noise at the other side, if you know what I mean. In the case of a low noise receiver at 10 gigahertz ham radio, I don't want the image channel coming through because it's creating noise that's lowering my signal to noise ratio by 3 dB. It's another channel of noise. And there, an image phasing mixer would give me a significant increase in sensitivity. I guess it's also possible in the case of acoustics, although I think it's rather rare that the electronics itself is making more noise than the environment, if you know what I mean. Although, I guess I don't want to listen to... I guess I don't want to listen to the ultrasonic noise of the leaves and the trees rustling at 37 kilohertz when I'm listening to my favorite bat that's putting out a chirp at 43 kilohertz. So there again, the image phasing mixer could give me a significant improvement in signal-to-noise ratio of the desired signal. But you start Googling the word image phasing mixer, image rejection mixer, and you'll find a lot of literature on that. And the explanation of how it works is a little bit elaborate. It's got a bunch of I's and Q's, in-phase and quadrature circuits mixed together just right, two separate mixers, and a pair of a quadrature hybrids hooked together just right, and it does that magic. Guarantee it can be done with operational amplifiers. Over to you for any further comments, Joe. The B2RYY, interesting stuff, K2RIW.
Okay, well, what I have to do now is just get together with you and get this thing, out of its parts and pieces, sit down, build it, and take it away, because the problem I'm having with the interference issue of my repeater, it comes and goes. There are days where it completely disappears. Like today, right now, because it's raining out, the problem is completely gone. Yesterday, it was so intense I couldn't talk to anything with a 41 HD from outside my house. So it's very severe. It's either very severe or it's completely gone. Very, very mysterious, this type of noise.
You know, when I get a chance later on tonight, I'm not even going to worry about whether or not you've got a valid ARRL membership right now where by which you can download this article. I've got a copy of the article. I'm going to ship it to you, to your website. So you can start looking at the article itself, studying it, and you and I will eventually get together on those parts. And there was another thing I was going to ask you. Forgotten it. Anything else I'm forgetting, Joe? K2RAW.
That's the first thing that goes, the memory. No, I don't know right now. Okay. So that covers me as far as the two different things I had to speak about as far as different subjects. Back to you. Back to the net.
Yeah. By the way, guys will quite often say the memory is the second thing that goes. And I forgot what the first thing is. Okay. At this time, we're going to go over to the more serious stuff, the more serious science. And for those who want a copy of the schematic diagram or the maybe information about the website that contains the YouTube videos of the early development of this rather elaborate, very sexy-looking circuit that Wesley N2XJN is coming up with, if you go to Bernie at huntfamily.com, that's Bernie, B-E-R-N-I-E, at huntfamily, H-U-N-T-F-A-M-I-L-Y.com, there you'll find out the latest information that Wes and John have supplied as to where they stand on the development of this product. And as you know, they're developing a product which quite a number of the serious amateur scientists, I'm going to call them, these guys are not necessarily working out of a university, but the university-type people in Europe have been working on the circuit for, I'm guessing, some number of years. And they have reason to believe they found a circuit that gives them some extra power. You put in X watts and you get out X plus Y watts of output. And the over-unity circuits. And Wes knows that if he can make that work on this side of the ocean, that people here in the United States would really appreciate it. He's about to offer it to people free of charge, so to speak, once it is thoroughly developed. But he and John and I, let me drop. He and I and John were admitting right off the bat that although Wes has gone to Europe and seen it operating, held it in his hands, looked at the meters, and watched it operating for a full half hour and producing a large amount of power output compared to the power output going in, he has seen it in operation, and it's hard for him to think that this is it's a hoax. It looks like it's awfully real. Even so, when Wes develops it here on in the United States, there's a chance that the project will not be successful. And that's not bad, because in the process of us all discussing how to make the measurements, how to evaluate the data, how to figure out what's happening, what is Mother Nature telling us, in the process it is educational. And even if it's a failure, it's not a failure. There are some scientists who say they get more information out of a failure than they do out of a success, because in the process of inspecting or studying why it didn't work, you quite often find out a whole lot of other things. So there's a lot to be learned here. And so there are people in the beginning, you know, saying all kinds of derogatory remarks. Hey, you guys are looking for perpetual motion. You're wasting your time. Well, there's a number of places in history where somebody said you're wasting your time, and eventually the person made a good working circuit and made a lot of money, and then had a chance to really laugh at the people who said he was wasting his time. So there's no guarantees, but now you know something about what we're doing, why we're trying to do it, and one way or another we're going to end up a little bit smarter, it says here. So I guess I'll turn it over to Wes first to find out. I saw some beautiful pictures that you're coming up with. The guys in Europe make a sloppier looking circuit that sits on the table, and you've made this